Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Once in a while, it's good to remember that the Baseball Bookshelf is not just about books, but about movies, magazines, collectibles, and illustrations, all of which can find a spot on a bookshelf. So here's artist Greg Kreindler, whom I first met 7 years ago when I did a profile on him for the New Jersey Jewish News. I say met because until last Thursday, at an event at the Yogi Berra Museum, which marked the 75th anniversary of Lou Gehrig's Luckiest Man speech, in fact, I had only known Greg Kreindler through emails, Facebook messages, and the very occasional phone call. So, after spending a good deal of time that evening chatting with Kreindler and his charming new wife, Sarvanez, I decided the conversation was long overdue. Greg Kreindler, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start off with the origin story of your name.
Okay. Well, my father, a very big Yankee fan, I guess really, really liked Greg Nettle, the third baseman for the Yankees in the 70s and early 80s. And I don't know the exact genesis of it, but I do know that though my father was a fan of Nettles, I think it was my mother, actually, who suggested the spelling to my father when I was born, which was April of 1980. And, yeah, they both agreed that they loved it, and I've been cursed with the name ever since.
But I imagine that, it's not that unusual name, but people just always seem to automatically think, no, that can't be right. It's got to be Craig.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I spent my my entire childhood and I guess some of my adulthood in classrooms where you're kind of waiting for the teacher to get to your name as they call attendance roll alphabetically, and as soon as you know that Kreindler is coming up, they'll kind of look at the name and they'll turn their head a little bit and they'll say, "Is it Greg or Craig?" And that's kind of the question that I always get first, and I correct them. And there are a few who I think are Yankee fans, and they kind of make the connection. They ask, you know, if it's any relation to Greg Nettles, and when I say that it is, they never get it wrong again. Though I do, I have friends or acquaintances who still to this day, I mean, I might have known them for 5-10 years, and they still aren't really sure exactly whether it's Greg or Craig, so I can't win either way.
So when did you decide that this, historical baseball portraits and events, when did you decide that was going to be your career?
I think, you know what, it might sound a little bit corny, but I think it kind of chose me in a way. And this was kind of in my last year of undergraduate studies at the School of Visual Arts. I'd been a fan of baseball growing up, and my father had a sizable collection of baseball cards that I used to really love. So I used to kind of copy his cards and try to draw up some of his heroes. I was still into baseball as I kind of went through my adolescence, but fell out of love or fell out of the passion for it. And when I went to SVA, I planned on being a book cover illustrator in kind of the science fiction and fantasy genres. And the last year, when I was a senior, I remember to this day, the professor gave us an assignment. He would always give us kind of a general assignment, and it was up to us to kind of hone in and take something specific out of it, something that appealed to us. And he wanted us to depict a relationship. And the relationship that I thought of pretty soon after racking my brain was just the relationship between a batter and a pitcher. And when I thought of that, I kind of liked the idea of maybe illustrating someone that my father would love, like a painting that my father would love to look at. So figured, well, his hero is Mickey Mantle, so why don't I do that? And I got very into the entire process of trying to make it historically accurate and, you know, trying to make sure that Mickey Mantle looked like Mickey Mantle and that in the particular scene that Ebbets Field looked like Ebbets Field. And I finished the painting, and it was kind of a breakthrough for me in that it was the first time I really, really loved the entire process of it. I loved researching. I loved painting it. I loved even talking about it. And I think it was right after that that it kind of clicked. I was like, well, maybe I'll do some more of these and see what happens. And it kind of just took off from there, I guess.
So the research aspect, you can tell a lot of painstaking research goes into this. It must be difficult, especially with some of the older black and white photos. I mean, they didn't have color photography as available in those days. So how do you compensate for that?
Well, there are other ways to go about it. It's like you mentioned, it's really hard to rely on color photography. I think in maybe the late 40s or early 50s, that was kind of when it started to become a bit more popular. But any time before then, you're not really able to find much black and or much color stuff. However, there are also tons and tons of home movies out there. And home movies that you know, that depict baseball games, that depict, you know, actual games at Yankee Stadium or Ebbets Field, and a lot of them dating back to the late 30s even are in color, because it was in, I think, 37 or 38 that color film kind of started to become widely available to the public. And there is a collection of those home movies in an HBO series that came out in the early 90s called When It Was a Game. And I was able to kind of get friendly with some of the people who own that footage and the people who produced that show, and they had kind of a treasure trove of stuff that really aided in my research, at least from those years. But when you go further back, well, unfortunately, the only thing that you can really rely on are newspaper accounts, or at least I find that you can only rely on newspaper accounts. There are certain years, say, you know, let's say in 1923 when Yankee Stadium opened, you know, every major newspaper is covering opening day and then the construction of this thing, and every reporter is describing the stadium, and many times these reporters are actually describing colors in the stadium, you know, the green seats or the colors of these advertisements or the colors of the little cinder racetrack that kind of was around the field's perimeter. And they're just little nuggets that I look for, stuff that was probably just, you know, throwaway color for these writers, but for me it's gold, and I just kind of have a mental and a physical database of stuff like that to kind of aid in my work. And you know, sometimes the colors that I choose are exact, or at least as exact as they can be from the information I've gathered, and other times they're just kind of educated guesses. I try to really, I guess, work out my color schemes with the actual stadiums with as much accuracy as I can. And then when it comes to the advertisements that are in said stadiums, I guess that's a bit more of a guessing game for me.
So, chicken and egg question. Are your paintings done on commission in that someone asks for a specific play or event, or do you just paint something and then look to sell it? Or is it a combination?
It's kind of a combination. I think for the most part, I work on commission. I'd say probably about 85% of what I do right now is on commission. Someone will approach me with maybe a particular photograph that they'd like me to paint, or they, you know, they have a favorite player that they want me to paint, or even, you know, just a particular moment in mind, and they'll want me to paint that. And those are a lot of fun to paint. I mean, I love painting pretty much every subject relating to baseball that you can throw at me. But there are also the things that I do on spec that are a little more personal to me. And those differ in the fact that, for the most part, when I'm painting for myself, I like painting players who you don't players that the casual baseball fan might not know about, or might not even know how they look. They might have heard their names or whatever, but they've never actually seen an image of them.
Can you give me examples?
Like right now in my studio, I have a small 16 by 20 portrait of Willie Keeler. And Willie Keeler was one of the, I guess, the greatest players from the early 20th century and late 19th century. And he was famous for that that quote that he said about advice about hitting, you know, the hit 'em where they ain't, keep a clear eye and hit 'em where they ain't. And he's a player that, you know, most baseball fans, they might have heard the name Willie Keeler, but they have no idea what he looks like for the most part. But for me, there's just a great appeal to kind of, there's an appeal to bringing people like him back to life. There's, in a way, it's kind of like I feel like I'm able to kind of connect with these players through painting them, and it sounds kind of corny maybe, but they're as important to the game as, you know, the hallowed names are. I mean, you know, Babe Ruth obviously is one of the biggest names in the sport's history, but I think that people like Willie Keeler and you know, Hoss Radburn and Jim Thorpe, people like that, they also have just the same kind of tie to the game that Babe Ruth does, and it's kind of part of this larger tapestry that I try to kind of tap into. And I guess it just interests me to kind of depict these players as just part of the history of the game. It's like part of the timeline that I try to visualize.
So describe a typical day at the studio. Where do you work? How many hours a day? Do you listen to anything like music or a ball game in the background while you compose? How does that work?
For the most part, well, my studio is in my apartment in Brooklyn. So it's basically just a walk down the hall to get there and get to work.
So let me cut in right here. When you went apartment shopping, did you look for some place that had, you know, you always hear about artists talking about the light that they need. Was that something that was important to you when you were looking for a residence?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have in my studio, I have kind of like a set of bay windows, so there is a lot of light that that penetrates through that and helps in my painting. But in addition to light, it was important for me to have high ceilings, because some of the paintings that I work on end up being really large, and when they're actually put on easels, or my easel, it's easier for me to kind of have more space to work with, so I can kind of, you know, crank my easel and move the painting up when I need to get to a lower part of it, rather than lying down on the floor. the light was very important. The size was very important, because I knew that I was going to have a lot of the in-progress works kind of strewn about the room. But at the same time, I also realized that I couldn't be super picky. I just saw something, or we saw something, should I say, and the room that I that I saw when we looked at this place, I just kind of knew right away. I was like, okay, this will work. This will definitely work.
How many hours a day do you put in?
I would say that I'm probably working 10 hours a day, every day. Right. However, I'd say that at least 4 or 5 hours of those 10 hours are devoted to painting, like actually painting. A lot of times it's more, but there are also those extra hours that I use for researching, because researching ends up being a huge part of the process.
Is there an occupational hazard for painters who are putting in those kind of hours? I mean, you always hear about chefs who are on their feet so long, so they develop problems with their legs and their backs. People who work at a keyboard develop carpal tunnel. Is there occupational hazards for painters?
You know what? If you asked me that about a year ago, I would say no. No, I mean, that's fine. You're up on your feet all day. It's fine, whatever. But about half a year ago, I developed a bit of bursitis in my shoulder. And I couldn't understand what it was from. And I remember going to my physical therapist, and he was asking me about my vocation. He didn't exactly ask what I did, but he just kind of started out asking, well, you know, do you, with your arm, it was my right arm, do you kind of, for your job, do you hold your right arm up and, you know, support the weight of your hand on anything for any, you know, large amount of time during the day? And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, I think I do. So, luckily, you know, I was given exercises to alleviate that pain, and it hasn't really bothered me since, but yes, I guess as I get older, I do become aware of more occupational hazards.
Now, you mentioned a while ago progressive paintings. Progressive paintings? What is that exactly?
Oh, in progress paintings.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, well...
So they're not like first drafts or anything, or are they?
No, they kind of are. Uh-huh. I mean, they end up being paintings that that will eventually, hopefully, turn into finished pieces. But they're kind of just in varying stages of completion. So one painting might just be kind of drawn on a canvas, and that's it. And I don't have anything else going on with it just yet. I just haven't gotten to actually starting the whole lock-in process. And then another painting might be, you know, maybe halfway through, where it's completely blocked in and there's color and, you know, you can make out who the player is, but it still looks sketchy and it's not necessarily refined. And then there are other paintings that might look pretty finished but still just need a bit of what I call buttoning up to call it a finished piece. And they're just tons and tons of those kind of scattered around the studio.
Do you work on one at a time from start to finish, or do you go back and forth between a lot of projects?
For the most part, I try to just focus on one at a time. But every now and again, I'll get into this mode where I'm working on something and I get a little... not bored of it, but I need to kind of stimulate something else or stimulate myself with something else. So I'll kind of start working on something else. And then, you know, a couple hours down the line, the same thing might happen, and then I might have to jump to even something else. So it all depends. I guess it all depends on what kind of stuff I have on my commission list, like what needs to be finished soon, and if there is kind of any leeway or flexibility in that, I might work on, you know, 4 or 5 paintings at once.
Dimensionally speaking, what's the smallest and largest paintings you've done?
The smallest paintings that I've done are actually these little color sketches. They're little studies. They're like little preparatory studies that I make for myself. They're just kind of to figure out, I guess, a color scheme or a value structure of a larger painting, those end up being 5 inches by 7 inches mostly. And they end up, you know, just being like little portraits for the most part, and they're a lot looser and more suggestive than the finished work. But on the other end of the spectrum, I think the largest painting that I've done is it's a painting of Mickey Mantle from his rookie year, and it's much larger than I am, which I guess doesn't really say much, but it's about 6 feet by 7 feet or so. I think the exact measurements were somewhere like in the maybe 68 inches by 86 inches or something like that. Just very, very big.
Now, you have a picture currently on display at the Yogi Berra Museum depicting Lou Gehrig's famous farewell speech. How big is that?
That painting is 48 inches by 84 inches, so I think that's 4 by 7.
So logistically, you mentioned the apartment before and needing high ceilings. I imagine you have to also consider how to get that thing out of the apartment when you're finished with it.
Yes, very much so.
You can carry through the hall, or do you have to open it through the window and let it down gently?
Well, luckily, at least with that painting and the Mickey Mantle painting that I had just mentioned, I was able to get them through the door. I was able to get them out of the apartment. It was very tough, though, and I needed help with it. There's a lot of strategic maneuvering that needs to happen when I'm trying to get down the stairwell in my apartment building. But it helps to have friends who are strong and willing to help you move things. That's for sure.
So is that something you have to take into consideration if somebody wants paint? So I can't do anything larger than what I can get out of my apartment.
For the most part. No one has ever
someplace else to do something extremely large?
Well, one thing that is good about, I guess, working large is that, I mean, I'm able to kind of, when somebody has an idea, and let's say they have a big idea and they want to make a big painting, I'm kind of able to, in my head, I'm able to kind of imagine, visualize what the painting would look like in my space and whether I can actually move it around the apartment if I need to and get it in and get it out successfully. No one has ever really asked for anything incredibly large, but if someone was to, I do have an agent in Westchester who has a pretty large gallery, and he's let me work there before on larger pieces. And I would imagine that the space that he has could probably handle much, much larger pieces a lot better than this apartment can. So I think I would have that option if somebody ever approached me and wanted something that large.
So just to give the listeners out there an idea, what would you charge? What are your rates for your paintings? What's the range?
Well, the small paintings, the color studies that I mentioned before, they are right now the least expensive options. They start at, I think, $599. And they basically, you can have a small, like, sizable portrait of a player, you know, a 9x12 or an 11x14 or 16x20. Those will range from $3,500 to around $4,500. And then if you go on the other side of things and you talk about, say, that giant Mickey Mantle painting, that painting would be around an $80,000 painting, I believe.
And the people who buy these paintings, are they buying it for their personal collections? Are they buying it for office settings? Combination?
It's, from what I understand, for the most part, the people who buy these are collectors. And it's usually for their own kind of personal collection, their own personal space, their homes. We have a few clients who have bought paintings for their corporate boardrooms and things like that. But more often than not, it's usually a collector who is really interested in, you know, a specific player.
So I imagine your work has appeared in many exhibits and locations. What do you have, a favorite place or some place that you take the greatest pride in that it's there?
Well, to be honest, I really think that there's a lot of pride in having something hang at the Yogi Berra Museum, especially since Yogi is basically, I think, my father's maybe second or third favorite player. I guess it's kind of hard to crack the number one spot when Mantle was there, but it was special to me to kind of be able to work with the Yogi Berra Museum and work with someone my father kind of grew up idolizing, and it's a point of pride. It really is.
If people want to learn more about yourself and your work, do you have a web presence you can tell them about?
Yes, I do indeed. I do have a website that they can feel free to check out. It's Greg Kreindler, GREIGKREINDLER.com. And I'm also very active on Facebook and on Twitter and Instagram. I think as long as you spell my name right, if you Google search me, you can find me with ease.
And we have been talking with artist Greg Kreindler. Greg, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Ron. It's my pleasure.
And that wraps up this baseball bookshelf conversation. I wish I could tell you who's coming on next, but I'm going to be taking a little break to concentrate on finishing up my new book. It's not a baseball book, but a book about the Maccabiah Games, also known as the Jewish Olympics. So I'm going to have to squeeze in a bookshelf conversation or two when I do find some time. In the meantime, please visit the Baseball Bookshelf, Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, for the latest news on baseball books. Thanks, everybody.
Old Christy Columb found this country by gum, but the extras don't carry his name. If old man Columbus had sat in the stands, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Cheer